Welcome, everyone, to episode 87 of Underserved. Joining us today from the Lone Star State is Joe Forrester, SVP of Engineering and Product at Choosel. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Joe, thank you very much for joining us today on Underserved.
Thank you for having me, Andrew. Looking forward to speaking with you today.
So when you were young, in your teens, you were interested in audio video. How did that kind of get you interested in technology?
Really just getting into understanding how all that worked. Yeah, I was a big fan of pretty much wiring everything in the house up in the most complicated way I could. So I was pretty much the only one that really knew how to operate anything. Drove everybody nuts, but I learned a lot from wiring things up to just getting interested in how all that was put together and how it was brought to life.
Did you read the manuals or just tear everything apart?
I just tear it apart and start from there.
Now, when you were in high school, you started kind of learning more the hardware side of the industry?
Yeah. So back in high school, I was really getting into just the hardware side of it, spending a lot of time at the nascent of the internet coming out, getting into really kind of building your own PC, buying things from parts versus going to Circuit City, purchasing hardware, things like that. It was really exciting being able to find the performance of what you were looking to do and build something custom, really not knowing a lot about it at the time and kind of learning as you went along.
Circuit City and Tweeter, rest in peace.
Right.
But you had some aspirations to be Maverick or maybe Iceman?
Yeah, that was the first love of my life was to be a military pilot. I really wanted to be a Navy pilot, Marine aviator, something like that. The biggest thing, growing up in the 80s, watching Top Gun was, probably a big piece of that. What I didn't tell anybody back then is, I was red, green, colorblind, which is an immediate disqualification for being a military and or a commercial pilot. I pretty much talked to everybody, talked to the Marines, talked to the Navy, the Air Force, the Army, even talked to the Coast Guard, Air National Guard, tried to, for lack of a better term, weasel my way into the program. Went through all the background tests, talked about everything I had to do. Never really told them I was red, green, colorblind, but eventually it would come out in the test and in the conversations we had. One way I tried to really get myself into it was I tried to convince them that, if you gave me somebody who could sit behind me that could tell colors, they would really have a vested interest in making sure that, I was on the right path coming in. They didn't quite believe that with a $35 million jet, though. Looking back, I'm not sure I blame them.
Yeah, I mean, I respect the approach, and, it's not unlike pair programming these days.
Extreme piloting.
Two heads are better than one. So what do you end up doing instead? I think you said you started a small company like doing LAN networks.
Yeah. So when I got into college, it was really the beginning of really wired Ethernets in the dormitories. Yeah, I went to Eastern Illinois University. And while I was there, probably halfway through my career there of education, they really started wiring up the new dorms for Ethernet, moving from token ring into the Ethernet technology and then moving it into the actual dorm rooms, moving away from dial-up modems. A friend of mine's mother worked in IT at a steel mill up in the Chicagoland area. And at that time, they were upgrading all their equipment. So we were able to rent an 18-foot Ryder truck. We loaded up with all the excess equipment they were getting rid of for no cost, and we drove it down to the university. And we began selling those, basically the network cards, for about $40 a pop and doing the install for about another $40. So we were about $80 in for about 10 minutes of work and really no inventory costs. And we wired up probably most of the Eastern Illinois dorm rooms at that point. It was an interesting time.
Now, at Eastern Illinois, you were pursuing a Bachelor of Science in Computer Management. If I recall correctly, that's one of those degrees that kind of mixes business and tech.
Yeah, it's an interesting degree, and it's one I recommend to a lot of people I talk to. So it's heavy in the business side. So you take all the traditional classes of economics and finance, accounting, business management, legal, things like that, but also layers in almost not quite a computer science degree. It layers in database programming and all the technology classes, systems design, et cetera. So coming out, you have a well-rounded understanding of what happens in the business industry, as well as how you impact that from a programmer, at least coming out of college from that perspective.
Well, shout out to previous underserved guests, Andrew Bauer and Dan Goldenberg, who were Syracuse iSchool grads, same sort of idea. I think it's a great idea. I did it manually, went to UMass Amherst management major, but took a bunch of CS courses. But yeah, I think that's a great way to hit the industry.
Yeah, I agree. So like I said, it gives you that broad exposure that I don't think you get coming out of a computer science degree. Well, you might get a better education in the computer science side. You don't quite understand the ramifications to the business world as far as growing your career long term, in my opinion.
So where were you interning after this?
So I started an internship my senior year coming out of Eastern at a company called Convergys, based out of a Chicago suburb, really doing mainframe programming. I think I was likely one of the last classes graduating that, you know, took a primary concentration coming out of a business degree with COBOL.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing. We still get demand for it today. We had folks calling us about Microfocus COBOL just yesterday. What were you building with COBOL back in the day?
So back in the day, we were building billing systems for some of the wireless carriers. So back then, my big client was AT&T Wireless before they became Singular and went back and all their affiliates. So we were responsible for all the bills you received in the mail, essentially from the point where the call was made, the mediation came off the trunks. We collected all that information, ran it through the billing drivers, and then created the bill that went out at the end of the day.
Yep. And you had to do the back end mediation, all the switches to set up call forwarding and all their features and everything?
All that. So I started off on the COBOL side doing the billing components. And then about a year into it, moved over to the client server side, doing a lot of, at that time, it was C programming. We were responsible for both the activation and the mediation side. The activation side was a really interesting part of the business. You know, if people remember back in the day, you'd walk in, get your phone, and it wasn't immediate that it was activated. You had to wait hours before you could actually use the phone that you purchased. What we did with the activation programs were, once we got the order for the activation in near real time, back in like 2002, 2003, we would take that, we would do the provisioning of that device on the HLR, which is a switch. We would then do the over-the-air activation, set up your voicemail accounts and their ancillary systems that were required. And at that point, you were then able to utilize your phone.
It's funny. In parallel, I was doing the exact same thing at EDS Personal Communication Division like 6 years before that. COBOL and C and talking to switches. So what made you kind of wind up there? Were they closing and consolidating?
Yeah, so they were a division of Cincinnati Bell Information Systems back then. In probably around 2007, we decided to ramp down that Itasca office in Chicago and consolidate operations back to Cincinnati and Orlando. So at that time, I decided it was time to move on to a new career. Got about 60 days notice and parlayed that into a new gig over at Axiom Corporation, shortly after the 2008 came into the year.
Now, marketing technology was new to you then. What was it like kind of drinking from the fire hose when you got there?
Yeah, it was interesting. I came in knowing a lot about technology, a lot about how networking databases and things like that work, but the whole marketing ecosystem was a new world to me. I spent a lot of time working with a lot of great people over at Axiom, learning about direct mail marketing, the postal service, how to do data cleansing, build master data management databases, and evolve that technology into what it became late 2000s into 2010.
Now, who are your customers then?
Back then, I worked within the automotive vertical. So a lot of my customers to start off with were like ADP dealer services, a lot of the large dealer networks like AutoNation in those dealer groups. Eventually moved into some more of the OEMs like Mercedes-Benz, General Motors, did a little bit of work with Ford back in the day. Touched a little bit on Honda, Toyota. It was an interesting time working with the automotive manufacturers back then.
But there were some Achilles heels with the luxury brands?
Yeah, the luxury brands were interesting. One thing I never would have thought of going into the marketing space was how careful you have to be as you communicate thanks for your order or thanks for your purchase. What I learned with some of the luxury brands were you didn't just mail a thank you letter back to the household that bought the vehicle. You had to mail it and address it to the individual that bought it. And what I learned was in the luxury brands, that was rife because a lot of men were buying their mistresses' cars that your wives didn't know about. So it would cause quite a bit of strife in the family if we didn't send that mailing out correctly to that individual.
That is a unique problem from mail merge.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
So you move from being a developer to a senior architect. What's that like?
Oh, that was interesting. So you're moving from, you're having day in and day out responsibilities of actually writing code and trying to move up one level to think about the systems holistically. I really enjoyed moving up there, getting to take just that complete look of how things, you know, manifested themselves, both from the data aspect, from user interactions, really layering in security, learning a lot around that point of view. It was great being able to build teams and really start getting my leadership skills put together as part of that move.
Tough economic climate, though. Like, how was the auto industry changing at the time?
It was an interesting time. I started working with General Motors up in Detroit. You're kind of at the bottom of the economy up there. It was interesting. We go to the Detroit offices. If you didn't leave the buildings by 5 o'clock, you couldn't get back up into the buildings because so many people were just, you know, leaving the city at that point in time. We watched them shut down. I think the brands they shut down during that time were Oldsmobile, Pontiac. I think Saab was one of the brands as well. Saturn. So we watched them dissolve those brands and refocus, you know, their efforts on GMC, Chevrolet, Buick, and Cadillac. And it was interesting being part of that because we got to watch them go from, you know, having the wide breadth of brands that they had in the marketplace, shut those down and become, you know, the company they really are today. It was great helping them do that and grow that with them.
Now, part of that, you became a patent holder, helping them develop some technology, right?
Yeah, it was interesting. With General Motors and some of the automotive industry there, we developed what we called the Advanced Automotive Recall System. And this was around the time there was a rash of recalls that were going on in the marketplace, traditionally among some of the lower-end vehicles that they had. That had some ignition recall issues with them. I'm sure folks remember that. What we did is we took the entire marketing ecosystem and kind of turned it on its end, where we used the power of the data we had within the databases, the information we could get from, you know, vehicle registration sites, and we applied advanced analytical targeting to that as well, where we built the segments of, you know, who was most likely to repair their vehicle, what were the barriers that wouldn't allow them to do that. Supply chain optimization and things like that. You know, back in the day when we started this, a typical successful recall would have been about 70% of the vehicles had been repaired. If memory serves right, I believe for this specific recall around the ignition switches, we drove that to upwards of 90% in the marketplace. And really, you know, from that perspective, we really helped people because that was a pretty significant recall event from a safety perspective.
Yeah, that's not easy because the same person that originally bought the car might not own it anymore. It might be two or three owners down the road, right?
Two or three owners down the road may not really be contactable from that perspective. So the big thing we did is, you know, historically recalls were more vehicle centric. I've got a VIN. I need this VIN to be repaired. You know, we turned that on its end and made it more of a consumer centric, you know, view where if you own multiple vehicles, we sent you one recall notice. You can take care of it once. If we knew the Northeast region, you know, had a supply chain problem of parts, we could slow down communications there and bring communications up faster in the South where maybe more parts were available. The goal was to make it as seamless of an operation for the owner as possible while they could get their car repaired. And we even, you know, helped drive communication where if we knew a lot of people were working at a plant or they were in a computer lot, we could do remote dispatch of repairs to those locations as well. So we kind of touched everything from a marketing perspective, but we used it from a safety recall. And it really changed, you know, how automotive, you know, does that in today's world.
Yeah, I mean, driving above 90% will definitely help make the roads safer as well. So you also had a project where you helped the airlines figure out how to try and get a bigger share of the wallet.
Yeah, this was an interesting project too. I was more involved in the periphery here, but it really, from my perspective, kind of shows the power of data and what it can do. It may be some of the privacy issues with it as well that we all deal with today. This would have been back in the, you know, probably the 2010 timeframe, but we had an airline client that was trying to determine what their share of wallet was in the industry. And the way we did that is, you know, we knew that people who flew on this airline, we knew who was on a manifest. So for instance, if a flight left Chicago at 10 a.m. and landed in Seattle at 2 p.m., you know, we would know who was on that. We would also know through other partner data that a cell phone went off the network at 10 a.m. in the morning and came back on at 2 p.m. And we were able to match that data up to a manifest and say, well, did this individual fly on this airline or do they fly, you know, on a different airline? Because we knew you couldn't drive in 4 hours to Seattle. What we did with that information then is if they weren't, you know, a loyal member of that airline, we could then do a retargeting or do a conquest campaign to try to move them over, you know, from the competitive airline onto to this airline to increase their sales. It was a pretty effective program back in the day.
I hadn't heard that before, a conquest campaign. So that's kind of to get market share from your competitors.
Right. So if you're a GM customer and Toyota's trying to conquest you, they're looking to basically steal you away and sell you a vehicle, change your brand loyalty.
Now, while you were at Axiom, was there any folks that were particularly helpful, like mentors or other folks that helped guide you there?
Yeah, I had a lot of great people I worked with there. One of the individuals that, very quickly took me under her wings was Angela Johnson, who was my leader there for 7+ years, really learned, a lot of the marketing business, really learned how to be a leader from her. It was a tremendous working opportunity.
While you were working for Axiom, you moved from Chicago to Houston?
Yes, that was at the tail end. So, I completed my tenure at Axiom and moved over to a company called, it's been many names at this point, but when I joined at the end of 2015, it was KBMG Group based out of Dallas and Houston. So I took that role, actually working with Angela. She had taken a position there a few years earlier, and I was in the market looking for a role and talked to her and got recommended to come over here. So as part of that transition, I moved from the Chicago area down to Houston, and made that move with the family. It's been a great move. Love living in Texas, working down here. It's just a great place to live and much different than living in Chicago.
But you got a bit of a rude hello with the weather when you got down there about a year in.
Yeah, we were here. I think we moved down here in 2016 and folks probably remember Hurricane Harvey. I guess it was August of 2017. I've never seen it rain so much in my entire life in 4 days. I think when that hurricane, or at that point, it was a tropical storm, came through, we received about 55 inches of rain. It was our welcome to Texas. Our first, full year being here, where our house flooded as part of that. And, you had to go through that experience. It was an interesting time. During that time, we probably met more people in the Houston area than we'd met in the year beforehand. And we're still friends with a lot of those folks today. It was interesting to see how just the community pulled together and came together for everybody.
You said 55 inches of water over 3 days?
55 inches of rain, like 3.5 days. Never saw it rain so much in my entire life.
Where does it all go? Like, does it wash out to sea?
Eventually. That was the other interesting thing I learned. So when we first moved here, we have what we call, there's a big reservoir. Well, I knew it was a reservoir that sat behind us, and there's this big park back there. But apparently what we learned is our house actually sits inside that reservoir as well. So as all that rain comes down, it's a watershed, they close the dams and it's impounded, and that really pushed up into to the neighborhood. So it was a life-opening event.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release,
deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office, and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
But with that move geographically, you also kind of moved from auto to healthcare?
Yeah, the primary industry I moved from by going to KBM was within the healthcare industry. So again, it was going into an industry I didn't really know anything about, moving from Axiom over to KBM.
What were you able to bring with you from your experience in the auto industry, and what was brand new and took some getting used to?
I think the biggest thing bringing over was just, the master data management component, right? So, identifying the right person across the sea of information and distilling that down to the most complete contactable view of an individual. So having the ability to understand how all that work coming from Axiom, coming from the automotive industry, and bringing that to help, expand that into the healthcare industry was a big thing. The hardest thing I learned going into healthcare was a lot of the privacy rules around PHI data, personally identifiable health information, and really the speed at which healthcare moves. On one hand, automotive was really kind of running at the forefront of marketing. They could do a lot with the data they had, a lot of agreements they could put in place. Healthcare being highly regulated, they were very adverse to moving fast and getting into new technology. So it was difficult trying to slow down and but pull them ahead at the same time. That was a kind of a you know, a yin and yang pull there.
Are the budgets similar? I would imagine that the automotive industry spends more on marketing, but maybe I'm wrong.
The automotive probably spends more overall in marketing, but when you start talking about Medicare and Medicaid and things like that, there's a tremendous amount of money spent by the healthcare companies in the Medicare space, you know, every year for open enrollment, primarily because once you sign up for Medicare, you're with that company for life. So they want to make sure that they get you in, because once they have you, you're part of their bottom line now going forward.
Is there no switching? Like you're locked in?
I'm not sure if you're locked in, but I think once people get set up, they have their doctors picked out, their, you know, providers, drug plans and all that. I think it's a hassle, you know, as an individual to join up, and they probably don't want to go through that for a second or third time.
Yeah, a lot of inertia.
Right.
Now, around 2020, at Wunderman gets bought by Choreograph.
Yeah, it wasn't really bought. So it's interesting. So these companies were all owned by WP. So it's a holding company in the marketing space. I think they have, you know, roughly 350-ish companies that sit in the umbrella. So KBM was owned by, you know, Wunderman, which became Wunderman Thompson. And in about 2020, they did a little bit of a shakeup where they moved part of the Wunderman Thompson data company, which I was part of. We consolidated it over with Group M Tech and became a company called Choreograph, which then sat under the Group M name. That happened early 2020.
And what happens in March of 2020 when everyone realizes they're not going into the office for quite some time?
Yeah, we quickly become going from a global-based company to a federated workforce with everybody sitting in their house working on their own. You know, almost overnight, as everybody knows, it's quite interesting for, you know, this global company, you know, with, yeah, I think at that time, well, I'm not sure, you know, Choreograph had about 350 employees, and, you know, overnight we all went remote and really, you know, picked up that lifestyle, you know, working from there.
What kind of projects are you doing now that you're at Choreograph at this time?
Really the same thing. So the premise behind Choreograph was taking the both sides of the data. So taking the Group M aspect, had the online, you know, components. Wunderman Thompson data had the offline components, and bringing that together. So day in and day out, a lot didn't change, but we went more from a technology revamp perspective. I really made, you know, big pushes into cloud. So at that time, you know, the Wunderman Thompson, you know, side, we had, you know, we owned our own data centers. We built our quote unquote our own virtual cloud within those data centers. In over 2019 into 2020, when that acquisition happened or that consolidation happened, began pushing heavy into the cloud technology and really architecting what that would look like for the future of that organization.
Is that where you met fellow underserved guest Bob Hammond?
That was. So Bob and I, you know, joined forces. He was the CTO of Choreograph when it was formed up. And at that point, I was, taken under his wing and his leadership within the organization. I pretty much kept ownership or leadership over, you know, under Bob, but for the legacy Wunderman Thompson side of the house, the data side, so our legacy healthcare clients and our data assets sat there. And then, you know, he brought in, you know, his digital expertise and the teams that he brought from the Group M Tech and formed the new organization.
Now, he had kind of gone from like smaller companies now becoming part of a bigger company. You were kind of heading the other direction. You'd only worked for big companies, and now we're getting some of that startup feel.
Yeah. So as I moved over to Chuzzle, this is the first, you know, small startup company I've worked for. You know, I think we're just north of 60 employees there. You know, my entire career working at Convergys, Axiom, you know, Wunderman Thompson Data, WPP, et cetera, I'd always worked for companies that had, you know, 8,000, 20,000, case of WPP, 100 plus thousand employees. So it's interesting moving from a company that has, you know, that much mass of employees working for them down to, you know, 60 individuals with an engineering team of, you know, about 16 individuals. What I've noticed is we're able to move a lot faster and get more things done because there's less inertia to overcome to be in making change within the organization.
Now, what does Chuzzle do?
So Chuzzle, we sit in we're in the programmatic side of the house. So we work with our clients for buying media and ad space, you know, whether it's on native websites, it's CTV, digital out-of-home experiences, things like that. We help our clients take their marketing needs and translate that down to the digital space in order to procure their marketing budgets.
Is the end buy like all kind of like real-time auction based, or is it how are you acquiring it?
It is. So we have partners we work with that are the DSPs. So we take our clients who generally aren't large enough to have seats on the DSPs, and we take our seats and we allow them to purchase, you know, on those platforms in locations they normally wouldn't have access to.
Now, on the personal side, like, you started playing music at a young age, right?
Yeah, I did. I probably was forced into it by my parents in the second grade, learned the piano. I actually really enjoyed that, stayed with it until really stayed with it with lessons and playing through my senior year in high school.
They broke a deal with you in high school, though, right?
They did break a deal with me. So, you know, when I joined high school, I wasn't really into singing or the choir, but I'd met the choir director and kind of made a deal with him saying, yeah, I'll join the choir, you know, but I'm going to be the accompanist for the choir. So we made our handshake deal in the commons, you know, train sign up or train registration. First day of school, I get there, they'd hired a professional accompanist that that was now in charge of playing for the choir. So yeah, I was not quite forced, but you know, moved into a singing role at that point. Oh yeah, and it being a good thing because it gave me kind of a foray into actually music production and mixing and laying down tracks and things like that. So the guy they hired, you know, took me under his wings and taught me a lot of that through the 4 years I was in high school.
Now, are you using like a digital audio workstation on the computer or like mixing by hand on a board?
It was all digital back then. So I think the software I used back in the day was Cakewalk. So it was on a PC, you know, through the keyboards, MIDI connections. It was nice.
Now, I see some guitars on the wall behind you there. When did you get into playing guitar?
Really got into playing guitar probably when I went to college. It was, you know, in a dorm room, couldn't really have a piano. I think I brought a keyboard with me, but, you know, I found a lot of joy just being able to, you know, pull out a guitar and kind of have stress relief, kind of taught myself how to play and, you know, just learn some things by ear. It was just a little change of pace. I think what I was talking earlier was much easier to carry around than a piano as well.
Yeah, for sure. With learning, like to turn to YouTube, are there any good lessons or channels or places that you pick up new guitar tips from?
Yeah, I think the best channel I watch on YouTube is a guy named Marty Schwartz. He teaches pretty much any song you could ever want and takes recommendations, has a huge following out there. But you know, he'll take any song, pretty much any song you could ever think of. He's got it broken down into, you know, small chunks that really teach you how to play those songs. Yeah, I really started off by reading tablature, things like that. But you know, having YouTube now to go into to learning really shows you some of the intricacies and different, you know, finger formations you need in a fretboard to be, you know, a more adept player.
Have you tried to pass down either technology or music to your son?
I have. I've been successful on one of those two. So yeah, my son, you know, played piano a little bit, did a little bit of drums. Yeah, he's a senior in high school right now. He's been in the marching band, in the band, you know, junior high and in high school, playing trumpet and mellophone, things like that. Absolutely loves it. I've tried, you know, getting more interested in technology, programming, things like that. And it's been probably chalk it up to an utter failure. Yeah, he just hasn't really enjoyed the programming aspect of it. You know, part of it, I think, is, you know, some of the teachers he's had in school for it, you know, probably weren't the best. So they didn't really instill a lot of passion, you know, for him in her, which has been a shame. So I try to work with him, but he's more interested in more of the business aspect of things. So really supporting him from the finance and accounting, you know, aspect, which he's really interested in pursuing in college.
He'll end up being the boss. It'll be fine.
Probably. Right. You take care of me when I get older.
I hear some barking in the background. Is that your soon to be 10-year-old lab, Cody?
That is. That's our black lab that we rescued up in Chicago before we moved down here to Houston. So I've got him locked in the back room, but unfortunately, I think we're hearing him a little bit here.
Now, with 55 inches of rain, but he's not a big fan of water, is he?
He's terrified of water. I think I have the only Labrador hunting dog. Well, he's not a hunter, but the only water dog who's, you know, afraid of getting in the water. You know, funny story, when we moved to Houston, the one requisite my son had before we moved here is we had to have a swimming pool, which, you know, surprisingly enough, right now, nobody uses, just sits back there. But I was playing catch with Cody in the backyard when we first moved in, threw the ball for him. You know, he turned left instead of right and fell into the pool. And I had to jump in and save my Labrador. I had to, you know, pull him out of the pool. He just, you know, completely freaked out. The good news is since then, he's never wanted to get back into water either. So it's worked out.
Well, if it's any consolation, I have a golden retriever, Brody, who seems to be very scared of the pool as well, wants nothing to do with it.
There you go.
Any other folks you want to give a shout out to?
You know, we talked about, you know, Bob and Angie a little bit. I've had, you know, pleasure working with some just really fantastic leaders through my career. I think I've been really lucky where I've never really had what I'll call any bad bosses, you know, especially over at at KBM, Wonderman Choreograph, you had a slew of great mentors there and individuals I worked with over the years, like, you know, Joe Brem, who ran our operations, you know, Tom Young, who was one of the ones that was instrumental in bringing me down to Texas initially. It's been great working with them. And the things they've taught me over the years has really helped me in my career moving forward. So it's been just fantastic having mentors have taken time out of their day to help others, you know, grow into what they are today. And I'm trying to take that and give it back to folks I work with today going forward.
Yeah, you got to pay it forward with the mentees. So Joe, thank you very much for joining us and sharing your stories with the listeners of Underserved.
Thanks for having me today, Andrew. It's been great speaking with you.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.